Refresh Your Feed with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the fifth episode of Robots. Today we speak with two robot passionates who have been bringing you their news and views on robotics through their blogs. We first speak to Steve Rainwater from Texas, who is a founding editor of Robots.net, a news website on robotics. We then go to Boston, where Michael Taylor invited Sabine to her apartment to talk about the IEEE Automaton blog and her work at Bluefin on autonomous underwater vehicles.
To start the show, let's hear about the latest robotics news from Christine.
Thank you, Sabine. Researchers at the Technical University of Delft have demonstrated a tiny robotic dragonfly. The Delftfly Micro is the smallest flapping wing robot carrying a camera to date. It weighs a mere 3 grams, which is less than your average piece of office paper, and it has a wingspan of 10 centimeters, which is about half the wingspan of some real dragonflies in Borneo. The dragonfly robot can be controlled from a computer and will transmit video images literally on the fly. The Delftfly team is already thinking about the first applications, such as surveillance of collapsed buildings. Software giant Microsoft has just demonstrated their work on what they call the receptionist of the future. An early version of the robot uses visual and voice recognition, as well as speech synthesis, to perform basic tasks. Microsoft itself will use the robot to handle shuttle requests in its own buildings. For the moment, Microsoft has only presented the software aspects of the robot, but Chief Research and Strategy Officer Craig Mundy hinted that the current software robot is, quote, just the tip of the iceberg. A new series of robot toys by robot toy maker Wowie has just hit the stores. The Live Cubs robot series includes a white tiger, a lion, a polar bear, and a panda robot cub. The plush animals have their own personality, but unlike other robot toys, were not designed to be easily customized or programmed. Early reviews are carefully positive, stressing the cub's cuteness factor. However, not everybody is convinced, with one member of our forum saying that such robots are way down in the uncanny valley, or in other words, they look a bit creepy. The cubs are recommended for children 3 and up and sell for around €40 or $60. So much for the news. As always, you can find details and discussions on the forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Let's go back to Adam, who spoke with Steve Rainwater, whose Robots.net blog has been winning awards and recognition since 2001. Besides his background as a software developer, he's been developing robots, talking about robots, writing about robots, and photographing robots for the 10,000-plus registered users visiting his website. Let's get an inside view from a decade-long hobbyist turned expert.
So hi, Stephen Rainwater. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Well, it's good to be here, and good to see the site kept going there. I've been checking out the podcast, and looks like it's an interesting thing you've got going.
Well, we're very glad you're one of our listeners. Can you tell us a bit about yourself, actually, and introduce yourself to all the other listeners?
Sure. My name is Steve, and I'm the... I guess the senior editor, you could say, on robots.net, and we're a news site that publishes stories on robots and AI. At the time we started, I think we were the only one out there. There are quite a few others now, some of them pretty good, but we're still around.
Excellent. Can you tell me a bit more about this site, actually? What is robots.net? What's the purpose? What do you post? What kind of news? Who is your audience?
Well, let's see. We post stories on just about anything that's related to robotics, to robots, AI, cognitive science, pretty much anything that we find interesting. And we mostly act like a blog. We publish links to existing stories and essays and papers. We occasionally publish original content, such as a product review or a book review here or there. But the majority of it will just be links to other stories that either we've found or one of our readers has found and submitted. So kind of along the same lines as Slashdot or something, but specific to robots.
Mm-hmm. Well, what makes you a little bit different then than Slashdot or some of these other websites?
Well, the main difference is probably that we've been around doing just robots and AI for a lot longer. And I can give you a fairly lengthy history about the whole site if you want, if your readers are not going to be bored by that.
Well, definitely. It depends if it's an interesting history.
Well, it dates back to the BBS days, if you remember dial-up bulletin boards.
I may have heard of them sometime.
We used to have modems that dialed over the phone lines and connected to bulletin boards, and people exchanged files and messages. Back in those days, I guess it would have been the mid to late 1980s, I started a bulletin board system called the Interocitor, which was specific to AI and robotics. Mm-hmm. And in addition to local messages and files, it also picked up the FidoNet Echo message groups related to AI and robotics. And over the years, the bulletin board evolved into other things. I began doing a website for the Dallas Personal Robotics Group. The file area of the Interocitor BBS eventually became something known as the AI CD-ROM, which was just a huge file collection on CD-ROM that you could buy of free software and back then a lot of shareware related to robotics. And that went on through several revisions, I guess, until most people got internet access, could download those files for themselves pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And that brings us up to maybe the early 90s. And I was beginning to think that we needed some other way to get news again. So we talked about it for a few years, and eventually myself and Roger Eric, who was one of the presidents of the DPRG, and later a third guy, Jim Brown, known online as the Swirling Brain, another DPRG ex-president, we kind of got together and decided to set up a new website. And I had intended to bring back the Interocitor name from the BBS, but it turned out that Roger Eric had some time ago snapped up the robots.net domain name, mm-hmm. back when you could get domain names like that easily.
Yeah, I guess right now it would be pretty difficult to get a name like that.
Yeah, it is, if not difficult, at least expensive. Mm-hmm. So we kind of lucked into that. And we decided to use that domain name. We combined some of our resources, and by this time I had been doing also the Usenet robot competition FAQ for some years, which is a list of frequently asked questions about robot contests. They're surprisingly few. Mostly the questions are, what contests are there, and when are they, and where are they? So it was basically just a large date-oriented list of upcoming robot contests. So we integrated that into robots.net as well. By the time we finally launched, I think it was around 2000 or maybe 2001 was the first year. And it's been pretty much unchanged visually since that time. If you take a look at the site, it has a kind of circa 2000 website look to it.
Not quite Web 2.0 just yet.
No, we're getting there, but we've been planning for a few years to do kind of a major visual facelift to the site, give it a new graphic look, and it does desperately need it. So hopefully that's something that'll get done in 2008 if we're lucky.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say
that kind of gets you to how we got there? And at the time we set all this up, there really were no other sites out there that where you could just go on a daily basis and get a new news story about robots and AI. Today, there are probably two dozen sites like that out there, you know, and many of them are pretty good. What we see a lot is new ones will pop up, and they'll try to do, you know, 10 stories a day or something, and then the editor gets burned out after a few months, and they vanish again. So there are a lot of them at any given time, but I think we're one of the few that's been there consistently doing it, trying to do at least one story a day for many years. And hopefully we'll continue to be there for a while.
So you seem to be involved in the hobbyist robotics kind of community for a very long time right now. What would you say were some of the biggest changes that happened? Maybe what started to bring robotics a little bit more into the mainstream and away from just the few people that were interested in it? Or is it still, do you think, a little on the back burner?
It's definitely more popular these days, and it's been sort of a steady growth curve over the years. I think the main difference now is just that there are more people involved. There hasn't been any amazing technological breakthrough. Embedded controllers may be a little bit less expensive than they used to be. But if you look at some of the earliest hobby robots, compare them to the latest hobby robots, there's really not that much difference. They aren't remarkably smarter or more capable now than they used to be. And that's a subject of frequent discussion at robot group meetings that I've been to at various places in the country, is pondering why that is and what it's going to take to get some kind of advance in hobby robots. But they seem to be just about as primitive today as ever. The upside is that there are a lot more people involved, and that's, I think, evident by the... we now have two hobby robot magazines, Servo Magazine and Robot Magazine, both of which seem to be doing pretty good, whereas 10 years ago, magazines couldn't stay in business just doing robots.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's maybe a question of money or maybe something else? Are the budgets just too small to do something interesting, or is it too complex and there's too much learning to do before you can start a real robot?
Those don't seem to be impediments. Frequently we see there's just not enough time available to do it as a hobby because it is a complex endeavor. But many of the people in the hobby robot groups do the same kind of work in their daily job. They may be scientists or researchers, or I do software development during the day. So in most cases, it's not a technological issue. I think to some extent, people just don't know what they need to do to make a more advanced robot. And I, for that matter, I think the real researchers are in kind of the same predicament. How do you make a robot conscious or have feelings? I don't think they know any more than we do how to do it. So they spend a lot more money trying crazy ideas, maybe, whereas we just sit around and talk about it. But we've produced about the same results.
Well, what do you think is needed to make robots a bit more practical? I mean, in the last few years, we've started getting Roombas in the house and other robots cutting our lawn. They're slowly coming into the house. What is the next step we need to do to actually have a robot in every home?
Well, that's a good question. I think part of the question is, are people really going to want that? And some people I've talked to really do, and others either don't care or actively oppose it. So it's going to be an interesting issue. I think we're at a point where it is going to be technically feasible, particularly with the technology you see coming out of Japan and Korea with humanoid robots. I think they're getting to the point where they are going to have humanoid robots that can do physically most of the things that a human can do. Whether or not they can find a use for them that will make individual consumers want to pay the money they're going to cost is another question. But I think we're getting to the point where it would be technically feasible.
Okay. What would you say maybe to to somebody who's interested in robotics, has seen it on the news, and is wondering how to get into the field and how to get started maybe on their own little project or get involved in someone else's project?
Well, the best way is find a local group. And there are groups in just about every state in the U.S. and just about every country in the world at this point, so you probably won't have far to go. Also, you'd want to look at some of the online communities. Robots.net is a good example. One of the other things that site does, in addition to news, is act as a sort of social networking site for robot builders, whether they're hobbyists or researchers or working in a commercial field. You can set up profiles and have blogs and talk to other users. So getting online and finding other people in your area with the same interest is a good way to start.
So an interesting anecdote is that you were apparently consulted for a CSI New York script. Can you tell us a bit about that? That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I do seem to get calls like that fairly frequently these days. The CSI New York guys were working on an idea for an episode, and I don't know if they ever shot that episode or not because of the technical problems, but it called for a person to be essentially assassinated by a robot.
I'm sorry, is this a spoiler in case the episode ever comes out? Or
probably not. My guess is that they never shot the episode.
Okay.
based on how the call went. But the idea was someone had constructed a robotic mechanism to fire a sniper rifle and then used that to assassinate someone. And there were various issues first in solving the crime, since there was no human there to pull the trigger, you know, who had committed the crime. And once they figure out it was the machine, they then had the usual assignment of blame problem of, you know, who actually is responsible for the crime. Is it the person who built the robot, the person who set it up? And they were more interested in, can you construct this thing for us that will actually fire the gun, or do you know somebody that has one? And so I gave them some advice on that. But I think in the end they determined that it was going to be too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a fairly common case these days to get calls like that. A similar case more recently, the Discovery Network is currently looking for a sort of a reality show idea based on a robotics contest, you know, something like Project Runway, but with teams of people that are building robots for specific events.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to give them some advice on, you know, how that might work. And don't know where that one's going. That one sounds like it might happen. So
that's really interesting.
You never know.
Yeah. So maybe as a last question, what's your take on the future of robotics? Just say like the next 10 years, where do you think the hobbyist market is going to go, and maybe consumer robots as well?
Well, I think consumer robots, we're just going to see, you know, more of the same, more advanced robots doing more things, particularly toys. Wowie has just been going nuts the last few years, cranking out all these toys. I think with Mark Tilden's help, more and more advanced little robots.
Mm-hmm.
Which also, in the end, helps the hobbyist because they can buy these things and hack them and
take them apart.
A more interesting question to me is what's going to happen to the hobbyist robotics community, because we're very much in a position where the homebrew computer clubs were 20 years ago. Back then, if you wanted to have a computer, you joined a computer club and you built one, and that was the way you got a computer. And you don't see clubs like that anymore, or at least it's very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Most people today just go to the store, buy a computer if they want one. And the computer clubs evolved into a variety of different things, maybe support groups for technical issues. They evolved into groups that write software, some of the free software groups out there that develop software, but they don't actually build hardware most of the time. And there may still be a few groups out there that hack hardware or do different kinds of do-it-yourself projects. So it's kind of an open question as to what's going to happen to the hobbyist robotics community over the next decade. Are they just going to vanish altogether? Will you just go out and buy a robot? Or Will they evolve into users groups for people who own robots? Mm-hmm. Who knows? We certainly talk about that a lot, but I think it's too early to say.
Well, I guess one way or another, we'll end up seeing it on robots.net, whatever happens.
That's true. We'll try to cover it and keep everybody informed.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Steve. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you, too.
Okay, and we'll keep reading the news on www.robots.net.
Yeah, we'll keep looking for the next Robots podcast.
Every 2 weeks.
Cool.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
We now go to Michael Taylor's kitchen with Sabine to talk about her experience as a blogger for IEEE's official robotics blog, Automaton. She'll be giving us her insight on the robotic trends which find their way into her posts and what blogging has taught her about robotics and its future. Finally, we'll touch on her background at the Bluefin Robotics Corporation, where she does research on autonomous underwater vehicles.
Hi, Micah. We're in your apartment in Boston, and you work on the IEEE Automaton blog. Can you maybe present, first of all, yourself?
So I have always kind of been interested in robots since high school, when I got involved with a high school robotics competition called FIRST. And when I went to college here in Boston, I got really excited about it, discovered it was really what I wanted to do in engineering. So I stayed involved with FIRST. I did some robotics projects as part of my classes. And then when I graduated, I started working for an underwater robotics company here in Boston called Bluefin Robotics. And so I'm just kind of a big robot geek, and the IEEE blog is a really fun way to do it outside of class.
Can you maybe describe this blog to us?
Yes, yeah, so the blog is from the IEEE, the Electrical Engineering Professional Association's point of view, to kind of engage people in what's going on in robotics lately. So we have a number of contributors, one from academia, one who is actually an IEEE reporter, and then myself, who's a robotics professional. And, you know, between the three of us, we kind of look for what's cool, what's new in robotics, what's fun, you know, how is it becoming mainstream, what's the effect it's having on people's lives, and write about it however we can to kind of make sure that, you know, people know about it, that they're excited about it, and they know what's coming up next.
And how has this experience changed your view on robotics?
I think it's really interesting how often robotics articles, it makes me look more for what robotics news is out there. And, you know, family members and friends will often send me articles about some new robot because they know I'm interested. But now, just, you know, having to go out and look for things to write about myself, I'm finding that it's becoming really mainstream. You know, every couple of days, CNN.com or BBC will have, you know, some new article about a totally random robot that I really wasn't expecting them to be reporting on. So it's exciting for me, you know, because I'm in this industry, that it's becoming popular and, you know, that it's a growing industry. So I'm happy to be seeing it. And I don't think I would have seen it as much if I weren't actively looking for it, as I am with the blog.
Have you noticed any trends in what the mainstream media likes to see in robots?
I think there are kind of two things they like to see. You know, there's military robots, which there's a good side and a bad side to that. I think it's, you know, I work for a company that makes robots for the military, for the U.S. Navy specifically. And, you know, from our point of view, you know, these robots are doing really important things. They are doing jobs that humans would otherwise be doing, and it's really dangerous work. And a lot of the articles will focus on that. They'll say, you know, look at these robots that are disarming IEDs. You know, they're saving soldiers' lives. But then you get the articles that are, you know, about how a robot accidentally pointed a gun at a soldier that it wasn't supposed to. And, you know, one, you know, the Predator, when it, you know, made its first kill with a Hellfire missile. And the media really jumps on stuff like that. And that can be, you know, tough to kind of answer for if people read it and they say, well, do your robots do this? And why are they doing this? Should they be doing this? And that raises a lot of questions, which I think it's a good dialogue to have. So that's why I'm glad to see it being reported on. But that's one thing they really like. I think the other thing too is the toys. Robot toys are kind of popular, especially Pleo the dinosaur that's come out recently. It's cute and it's fun, and kids like it and adults like it, and that's something they really like to jump on as well.
And you, as a contributor to the IEEE automaton, what do you like to see? What do you like to report on?
I like consumer robots. I like the robots like the Roomba, like the robotic lawnmowers, things like that, that are actually getting out into people's homes. I think it is so cool that you can go buy a robot. You know, you, after watching so much science fiction growing up, now you have a robot in your home doing what you ask it to. You know, they're still very simple. They're still very basic. They're still very limited, but that's incredibly exciting. You know, that's something you can give somebody for Christmas, and that technology has come so far so quickly that it's something that you can buy and hand to somebody as a gift is really incredible. So that's what I get excited about.
So with the Bluefin company, you've also been working on robots which will work in real life as opposed to maybe in the lab. Yep. So basically, what are you doing in the Bluefin company?
So Bluefin makes autonomous underwater vehicles, or AUVs. There are two kind of underwater robots, I guess. There's ROVs, remotely operated vehicles, and that's what you saw, you know, exploring the Titanic in the movie. Somebody's driving it with a joystick. Ours are autonomous. You load in a mission and then let it go, and it goes and it comes back, you know, hours later, days later, months later, whatever, and it's completed its mission. So AUVs are used by a lot of different people. They are used by academics to do research on navigation techniques because underwater navigation is really hard. You don't have GPS. They do oceanographic research, a lot of water quality and climate data that can contribute to global warming sorts of things. And they'll also do things like archaeology, underwater archaeology, you know, looking at, you know, you can find pots and amphoras, you know, off the coast of Italy or Greece or whatever. You can do treasure hunting with them. There are people who do treasure hunting with AUVs. It's very expensive, but you can do it. And then there's oil and gas companies can do surveys of the ocean floor to see where they can lay pipe or cable or whatever. And then there's also military applications. So looking for underwater mines, identifying where they are, and then allowing the Navy to disarm them.
And what does an AUV look like?
It looks like a torpedo, actually. It looks like a big yellow torpedo. Most of them are mostly yellow because it's easy to see when you're recovering them in the water. And that always kind of scares people in Boston Harbor who see them when we bring them out on the boat. They can be anywhere from, you know, maybe 5 feet long to 15 feet long, depending on the payload. And we make the small AUVs. They're 21 inches in diameter and maybe 15 feet long at most. Those are small compared to what else is out there. And so they have propellers on the back. You know, they're based off of the torpedo shape because it's very efficient to move through the water.
And what are the challenges in making AUVs? How do you control them?
You control them. Navigation is a big challenge. Like I said, the navigation without a GPS is very difficult. So you have a number of underwater sensors. You have inertial navigation sensors. You have a something called a Doppler velocity logger, which, you know, tracks your velocity along the ocean floor. You have compasses. You've got there are a number of ways to use like acoustic location with a boat to work out where you are. There are a lot of different ways to do it, and every AUV out there uses a combination of those sensors to try and do it. And so it can direct itself that way. There's also another big challenge just is the depth, because water is very heavy, and to go very deep, you know, you're looking at about 6,000 meters depth to cover most of the ocean floor. That's a lot of water pressure, and so that changes the kind of materials you're using to build it. That changes, you know, how cold temperatures your electronics need to be able to handle. It changes how much battery life that you need, because you need to go very deep. That takes a long time just to get down to that depth. And so you'll get classes of AUVs that are made for specific depths, and they're steadily going deeper and deeper, but then they get heavier and bigger and more expensive. So there's still a lot of trade-offs to be made for the deep water vehicles that I think all the AUV companies are working on.
So typically, are you working towards getting AUVs which are autonomous, which can avoid obstacles and basically do whatever task they have to do on their own?
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting question. The there are AAVs out there, and I think we've built one in the past that have obstacle avoidance capabilities. It's certainly an option, but the nice thing about water, which is very similar actually to UAVs, aerial vehicles, is that there's not a lot there to run into. That's very different from something like a ground vehicle where it's going to encounter trees and rocks and animals and people and buildings. The ocean is relatively empty. So obstacle avoidance right now isn't a really big push technologically, but the capability is out there. It's just, you know, an extra expense that a lot of customers just aren't interested in. But it's there.
And so in terms of autonomously having them do something, basically, could you give a task to an AUV and it would perform everything it needs to do to get to that task?
Yeah, you still have to tell AUVs pretty explicitly what to do. So for example, what we do with them is we tell them where to go, right? So they carry one kind of payload. They'll carry one set of sensors. Maybe it's oceanographic sensors. Maybe it's a sonar to take imagery. But they'll only carry one thing. And the whole time that they are on, they'll be recording that data. What we tell them is where to go. So do you do track lines? Do you do like a lawnmower pattern? Do you do a star? Are you looking for, you know, a certain shipwreck and you think you know where it is? So you just run over it a bunch of times, kind of in a star pattern, to get all the imagery you can and get all that navigation data. So you can't really, there's not a lot that AUVs can do by themselves. They can't pick things up. They can't manipulate objects like an ROV can. An ROV might have a robotic arm on it. AUVs are basically just there to survey, essentially. And so that task is relatively easy to make autonomous. The trick is just the navigation.
And how do you test your AUVs?
Well, the only way to test an underwater robot is to actually put it underwater. So it's part of the reason that we're located here in Boston. We have an operations facility right on the water and a couple boats that we rent out and one boat that we own. And we just take them out in the harbor and put them in the water and really hope they come back. We do, you know, dockside testing and so forth to start with to make sure that they're going to do what we expect them to do. But we take them out on the boat. You spend a day out on the water, launching and recovering the vehicle, looking at the data that comes back from the sensors, making sure it's doing the right thing. And it's pretty cool. That's one of the coolest parts of the job is you go out there and you're in the ocean and you literally push this thing off the back of the boat, watch it go in the water, wait there for a couple of hours and drive the boat to a different location. And, you know, somebody says the robot's going to come right back up here. And sure enough, a few minutes later, it pops up right in front of you. And it's just incredible that it traveled so much distance for so much time, but you can know exactly where it's going to come back up. And that's just so cool.
Do you have any anecdotes on what can or has gone wrong?
Well, I haven't been there for these. Occasionally, we set them to think that they're in Boston or that their home is in Boston when they're operating in Boston, which is pretty standard. But we, I think at one point, shipped one out to California to a research lab there to use, and nobody reset the home location. And so it was out there and, you know, somebody told it to wrap up and go home and it thought, great, go home to Boston. And so it kind of went directly back toward the land. Which was not what we wanted it to do. And occasionally they will get lost. You know, we have a lot of emergency and backup systems. They'll wash up on shore and, you know, almost cause international incidents. No, nothing that bad. But they do wash up on shore. People get very confused. They look like torpedoes, and so they're a little bit unnerving if people find them. But there is a very nice little tag on there that says, if found, please call this number. So we try to make them friendly and obvious that it's not actually anything dangerous.
Let's look a bit into the future now. Mm-hmm. So you have all this insight into what's happening in robotics today. What do you think will be happening in robotics in the next 10 to 20 years?
Oh, the next 10 to 20 years in robotics, that's a long time. There's a lot of developments to be made in that time. I think that the trend right now is toward more specialized robots. I think it's unlikely that you're going to have, you know, Rosie, the Jetsons robot who does everything for you. And I think that a lot of technology will keep developing off in paths that are diverging from each other rather than converging into one single robot. You know, I heard Helen Grainer, who was one of the co-founders of iRobot, had a talk on NPR's radio show Science Friday. And she was saying that when they were doing consumer focus groups about the Roomba vacuuming robot, they asked people, do you want a robotic vacuum cleaner? And everybody had this image of, you know, this big kind of humanoid thing that would pull out and push around a vacuum. And they said, no, of course not. Well, the Roomba looks nothing like a vacuum. It looks like a little disc. There's no reason to have it look big and like a human. And so I think while everybody kind of has in their mind that they're going to build these big human-looking robots to be your personal servants, I think there's no reason for them to be. So I think they'll just keep developing, you know, small, easy, portable, reliable, cheap robots that can do lots of different things. You have them all over your house, and they just take care of what you need to take care of.
And what are the challenges that you think need to be addressed now in robotics?
I think the components probably need to get cheaper, especially battery life. Battery life is a problem no matter what. It's a real problem for our underwater robots because underwater batteries are, you know, few and far between, and so are water batteries that can take all the water pressure. But that's true of ground vehicles, that's true of aerial vehicles, it's true of the robots you have in your home. You know, the Pleo dinosaur robot has to recharge every 3 hours. Your Roomba, you know, most of the cost of that Roomba is probably in that battery, and it's only good for maybe a year or so. I think batteries and power are a big deal. The other thing I think is, I'm guessing that there will come a time in the near future when you'll end up having to install some kind of navigation system in your home for your robots to deal with, you know, that your vacuum cleaning robot and your bathroom cleaning robot and your dusting robot and all of your other robots will all rely on, you know, one set of infrared beacons or something that you stick around your house and they're able to navigate through there. But I think if they're going to do that, the trick is standardizing something, which a lot of different robotics companies may not want to come together and work on. So it'll be interesting to see how they deal with that. I think there needs to be some kind of home standard so that people can make robots for the home that already fit into an infrastructure.
Thanks, Michael, for giving us your insight on robotics and on AUVs.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show on Robot Passion on the Web. For more information on today's guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
We hope to see you on our forum to discuss the latest news and hot topics on robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Refresh your feed with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.